There is this thing.
Do you realize
what is there is this thing?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What?
Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to Off the Hour. This is CKUT 90.3 FM. This is the Friday, December 12th edition of the program. And on today's program, the 27th installment of Radio Sanctuary. Abdelkader Balouni, or Kader to his friends, is a refugee from Algeria who came to Montreal via the U.S. Kader is in sanctuary inside of St. Gabriel's Catholic Church in his community of Point St. Charles. Kader defied an order to be deported on January 5th, 2006, and has remained in sanctuary ever since. CKUT is a community radio station proudly embedded in social movements for social justice, particularly those of migrants in Montreal. And since Kader cannot leave the church, CKUT joins him inside of sanctuary of St. Gabriel's Church in the heart of Point St. Charles. Do stay tuned for this bilingual radio program. Today is a very special edition of the program. Kader is participating in Radio 1812. This is an event to mark the International Migrants Day. And on this special edition, Kader has invited a social worker, a physician, and a lawyer to speak about the issues that directly affect non-status people in Montreal and in Canada. The show will also feature a live performance from three local musicians, well, four local musicians. So do stay tuned for that. This is CKUT 90.3 FM. We're going to go live to Radio Sanctuary with Kader Balouni in just a moment. Do stay tuned.
Bonjour, aujourd'hui c'est le 27e de l'émission de radio Hour of Power. Aujourd'hui, comme Grand Chen il a mentionné, qu'on a un docteur, une avocate et un travailleur social. En même temps, on a trois musiciens qui vont jouer à nous un petit peu de musique. Mais avant ça, je veux dire à quelqu'un de trois musiciens, il va dire quelques mots. Il va nous dire qu'est-ce qu'il va jouer. Et le microphone, il est entre les trois personnes.
Alors, on va jouer I Fall to Pieces de Patsy Cline.
Patsy Cline. And go for it. This is Kader B. Hour of Power.
Thank you.
super, guys. Vous, vraiment, c'est bon. Je veux remercier les trois. On va retourner à vous après 15 ou 20 minutes de discussion. Comme j'ai dit, on a une avocate aujourd'hui, c'est le maître Cathy Ramsey qui va nous parler, et docteur Samir et Isabelle qui vont nous parler de travail social aussi. Mais c'est les trois sujets, trois personnes qui vont en parler dans le même sujet, sauf chacun, c'est normal, ça. Cathy.
Oui.
Bonjour, Cathy.
Bonjour, Kada.
Ça va?
Oui.
Ben, je sais que on a fêté le 60e anniversaire de nos droits humains. Le monde, je veux seulement savoir, le monde, il est où de l'humanité? Est-ce qu'il y a une amélioration un petit peu, ou on est toujours loin de nos droits humains?
Oh boy, c'est une grosse question. Où on est rendu dans le monde, dans les droits humains? Moi, peut-être je vais parler plutôt de mon expérience ici au Canada, telle qu'avocate qui travaille en droit d'immigration. Et plutôt dans ce domaine-là, je peux dire où on est rendu dans le respect des droits humains par rapport à nos lois d'immigration et les pratiques de citoyenneté et immigration au Canada. Ça va?
Oui, go ahead. Okay. I'll listen to you, doctor.
Okay. Mais selon moi, on est loin de protéger les droits humains des personnes qui viennent ici pour être protégées par le Canada. Et moi, je suis d'avis que le Canada a une réputation d'être un pays humanitaire, mais c'est seulement ça, c'est comme une réputation, mais dans la réalité, on voit que c'est complètement l'inverse. Et je vois qu'on a un système d'immigration qui ne respecte pas les droits humains. Et je pense que même il y a quelques décisions de les Nations Unies qui disent exactement ça. Parce que notre système d'asile prévoit que seulement une personne qui n'a pas un juge, qui n'a pas besoin d'avoir aucun entraînement dans ce domaine de droit, qui prend un cours très, très court de 3 semaines de sensibilisation, prendre des décisions seules dans une demande d'asile, de laquelle il n'y a aucun appel, même si c'est prévu dans la loi, ça n'a jamais été mis en vigueur par le gouvernement. Et donc, il y a juste quelques recours pour une personne qui perd leur demande d'asile. Ils ont juste quelques recours pour obtenir le statut, puis ce sont des recours vraiment très limités et discrétionnaire. Et donc, c'est pour cette raison-là qu'il y a quelques décisions des Nations Unies qui disent que le système de Canada, le système d'immigration au Canada ne rencontre pas, ce ne sont pas des vrais recours et donc ils ne rencontrent pas les critères internationaux de recours judiciaire. Alors, je pense qu'il y a un gros manquement dans le système d'immigration au Canada du respect des droits de la personne. Et donc, de mon avis, on est loin d'être où on devrait être ce 60e anniversaire.
C'est la même question, sauf avec d'autres façons, pour Dr. Samir Shaheen. Bonjour, Monsieur Dr. Samir Shaheen.
Salut, Kader.
Salut. Ben, comme Cathy, Maître Cathy il a expliqué qu'on est loin, mais vous, comme un docteur, vous voyez, est-ce que les soins de les gens qui sont, on parle pour les gens qui n'ont pas de statut ici, on n'a pas de papier, ils vivent en underground, on dit en clandestinement. Est-ce que vous croyez que on a rendu à ce point que on ne traite les gens qui n'ont pas de papier comme des êtres humains? Ou on le laisse tomber?
Ben, je vais parler pour moi-même, parce qu'évidemment, c'est juste mon expérience sur laquelle je peux commenter. Pour moi, c'est certain que les gens qui sont sans papier ne sont pas traités de la même façon que les gens qui ont leur papier, ça c'est certain. Et je dirais que la question que tu poses, je pense que c'est dans l'affirmative, c'est-à-dire que je pense que les gens qui n'ont pas de papier, qui sont sans statut, qui sont underground, n'ont pas les services de santé qu'ils doivent avoir. Et donc, les services préventifs tels que les services aux médicaments, etc., ne sont pas disponibles la plupart des temps à ces personnes. Puis ça, c'est quand on parle spécifiquement des gens qui sont sans statut. Certainement, si les gens qui sont sans statut vont aller à l'urgence, par exemple, ils vont être traités. Mais souvent, ce qui arrive, c'est que avant qu'ils s'inscrivent à l'urgence, les personnes qui travaillent là-bas vont demander soit que la personne ou la famille paye d'avance, donc ça peut être quelques $100. Sinon, ils vont demander une carte de crédit juste au début. Et donc, souvent, si la famille n'a pas cet argent ou n'a pas une carte de crédit, la famille va juste partir ou la personne va juste partir. Et évidemment, c'est un grand risque parce que si c'est une condition médicale qui est assez aiguë, la personne va devenir beaucoup plus malade jusqu'à temps que la situation devienne pas mal une crise de santé pour la personne et que la personne doit revenir à l'hôpital quand elle est beaucoup plus malade. Et donc, je pense que ça, c'est évidemment, ça décourage les gens d'accéder au système de soins. Et ça, c'est juste pour les soins qui sont des soins d'urgence. Les soins, comme j'avais dit, des visites de clinique, des soins préventifs, ça, c'est pas couvert du tout. Et puis, donc, les personnes qui sont sans statut vont simplement pas être vues. Par les spécialistes ou comme un médecin de première ligne.
OK. Je veux passer le micro à Madame Isabelle. Madame Isabelle, I heard Samir what he said, yeah? Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, can you talk to me about your experience because you're working so approach to personal status?
Okay, well, as a social worker working in the C3S, which is a government agency, I work under in a team called Enfance Famille Jeunesse. So, and our mandate my mandate as a social worker is to work with the most vulnerable families in our community with children age 0 to 18. And I'm telling you this because I think that we do a really good job in regards to reaching out and providing preventative services and, you know, both health and social services, psychosocial services in general, for people with status and also for people who are in midst of trying to get their status, whether it's through you know, whether they, they've just made a refugee claim or so on. But where I find the families that we don't reach, who are the most vulnerable in our community, are the people without status. And in fact, we tend to meet them once their situation has deteriorated to the point that they're in crisis. Where was I going with this? So it sort of defeats our mandate in the sense of reaching out to the most vulnerable people. So for an example, you know, often we will, there's people who have been living in our community from, you know, up to 5, 10, 15 years without status. And we have never been able to offer them any type of services, whether it's social or medical services. But we meet them because they've, you know, for an example, they've had a baby, and we have been alerted to the fact that they've had a baby because of this mandate and in which the hospitals alert the CLSC of a baby, the avis de naissance. So oftentimes I will meet somebody once they've had a baby, and because basically a nurse will go out to meet these families, and will realize that they've been here for years and years and years without status, and that there's a number of issues associated with the fact that they haven't got their status, and I will meet these people, and I will realize that we haven't done our job in terms of of doing preventative.
Anyway, here I have a question for Samir. Isabel, she talk. Did you hear what she said? And question for you, Samir. Last time, the discussion between me and you, you talked to me about the girl, the woman. She's a Mexican woman. Her husband is Canadian. She make a baby, like birth baby, and after that, she had trouble because she doesn't have status. Can you talk to me again about the story?
Wait, I don't know the woman, but this was a case that was covered in the Montreal Gazette on the 27th of November was when the story was first published, if I remember correctly. Basically, the story is, like you said, is there's a Mexican woman who I believe would be on here on a visitor's visa. Who is married to a man with Canadian citizenship, and they had a child. She gave birth basically at the end of November. The baby was obviously born here, so it would be given Canadian citizenship. But what happened was that the obstetrician who was following this woman at Lakeshore Hospital basically withheld the baby's birth documents after the baby was born, because the family couldn't pay for the services that the woman received. And eventually, basically, what happened was that I think the family went public, which is very rare, but it's very a good thing that they did that. And within 24 to 48 hours, the obstetrician, you know, filled out the birth certificate and registration and went through the usual channels. And so that issue was sort of dealt with for the baby, but obviously it speaks to a bigger issue, which is that this happens quite frequently, actually. And we've known in our networks that at different hospitals, and one that we know specifically has been the Jewish General Hospital, this has happened in the past where, you know, where either birth documents will be withheld and mothers will basically be forced to give birth, you know, in places where they necessarily didn't want to. And potentially, although obviously not always, but potentially putting their kids at risk as well. And here what we saw was basically the baby being held, you know, the baby's birth documents basically being held ransom until the family was able to pay. And the family's income was primarily coming from the baby's father, who was working a relatively low-paying job. And he had actually offered to pay in installments to the obstetrician, and the obstetrician refused apparently that as well. She wanted the money in bulk, like in one shot. So... again, I think in this situation, the issue got dealt with, but it could have been dangerous because the obstetrician or anyone who signs a birth declaration, and midwives can do this, family physicians can do this, whoever signs a birth declaration starts a process that allows for babies to get Medicare coverage, health coverage, public health care coverage. And so by withholding those documents, this obstetrician basically risked this baby's health by delaying the process by which the baby would be covered from a public healthcare perspective. But I think the bigger thing that this did was that it scared people and probably sent a chill effect for people who would think about coming to a hospital to give birth if they didn't have papers, which is obviously a horrendous thing to be doing.
Okay, that's the question for the lawyer, Katia Ramsey. Est-ce que vous voyez que la dame de nutrition, she has a right to hold the paper?
Well, I'm more of an immigration lawyer than a professional responsibility lawyer, but it's kind of more of a question I think Samir
would
know.
Because we're talking about the human right. You know, the droits humains ici. Est-ce qu'il a le droit pour saisir le papier d'un enfant qui est né quelques heures?
Well, I actually don't even think it's a human rights question. I think it's a professional responsibility question. I mean, the baby by birth is a Canadian citizen and is entitled to those papers. So I think it's more of a professional responsibility, particularly doctors take an oath and their primary responsibility is to the care. But this is more Samir's domain than mine in terms of the first, their first priority is the care of the people they're treating. So, and I mean, I guess it is a human rights question to a certain degree. Obviously, denying a person or denying a baby proper health care because of payment is obviously a denial of that baby's right to safety and security of the person. So it could definitely be a human rights issue.
But this baby is Canadian.
Yes, by birth, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, as soon as you're born on Canadian soil, you're a Canadian citizen.
Yeah, he. You don't think he's not lucky the first hour he came in the war?
Pardon?
He was not lucky the first hour he came in the war?
I guess not.
Okay. Maintenant, on va arrêter de parler un petit peu. Comme je dis, je retourne à vous, les musiciens. Est-ce que vous êtes prêts pour nous jouer quelque chose?
Oui.
C'est quoi? Qu'est-ce que vous voulez nous jouer? Go for it. We're happy to listen to you guys.
Thank you.
Super. Je vous remercie beaucoup. Mais restez avec nous. On va vous faire jouer une autre fois, la troisième fois. Et ça va être très bon et ça va être la fin pour vous. Restez avec nous. On va jouer la musique une autre fois. Bon, ma question à Samir Shaheen. Monsieur Samir, où les réfugiés? Moi, je suis quelqu'un qui était réfugié. Et je ne crois pas que maintenant je suis réfugié. Je suis un Canadien maintenant. Bon, notre problème, ou le problème des réfugiés, toujours qu'ils parlent entre eux, quand ils rentrent à l'hôpital ou à la clinique, il y a des grands papiers que l'immigration, ils les donnent. Des grands, 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 grands papiers. Tu ne peux pas imaginer. Et tellement ça nous dérange, là, on ne peut même pas le sortir. Parce que si tu le montres, qu'on le sort, ah, what is that? What kind of paper you have? Oh, because I'm a refugee. Oh. Est-ce que vous, Samir, comme, est-ce que votre expérience, est-ce qu'il y a des malades qui viennent vous voir? Est-ce qu'ils ont te parlé de ça? Est-ce que vous avez, est-ce que vous, vous connaissez qu'est-ce que je parle, de quoi je parle pour les papiers, les grands papiers, là?
Ouais.
Est-ce qu'il y a des malades qui viennent, qui disent, écoute, docteur, ça c'est des papiers qui nous dérangent, ou c'est pas comme les autres qui sortent seulement des petits papiers. Je sais pas, est-ce que ça te dit quelque chose cette question? Parce que c'est vraiment, parce que moi, j'ai complimenté, j'ai dit à la docteur, ben, je suis réfugié, ça me dérange ça beaucoup. Je sais pas, est-ce que vous vous questionnez aussi les gens qui viennent chez vous, c'est quoi ça?
Ben en fait, ben je pense qu'il faut essayer de distinguer un peu entre moi et puis ce qu'on fait à l'hôpital. Donc à l'hôpital, je pense que l'expérience dont tu parles, c'est quelque chose que les gens qui sont ici comme réfugiés ou qui sont en train de revendiquer leur statut de réfugié, ils vivent ça d'une façon assez régulière. Et puis, je pense qu'avec certaines personnes à qui j'ai parlé déjà, qui ont vécu cette expérience, c'est certain que c'est souvent humiliant et très difficile parce que, comme tu viens de dire, il faut montrer un papier. En fait, c'est un papier que le gouvernement fédéral donne pour avoir certains soins de santé couverts par l'assurance fédérale. Et donc, quand les gens vont venir, ils doivent présenter ce genre de certificat. Mais en faisant ça, ça leur identifie comme des gens qui sont en train de revendiquer leur statut de réfugié. Et donc, avec ça vient souvent la discrimination. Souvent, quand les gens vont s'inscrire à l'hôpital, par exemple, ils vont aussitôt qu'ils essaient d'inscrire, les gens vont leur suggérer d'aller quelque part d'autre, comme à leur CLSC, par exemple. Mm-hmm. Des fois, dans certaines cliniques, je sais que les gens ont été refusés d'être vus. Moi, je travaille dans un hôpital pour enfants, donc c'est une expérience plus avec les enfants que j'ai. Et puis, donc ça va arriver assez fréquemment. Pour moi, personnellement, quand je suis informé par rapport à ces événements qui arrivent à des gens, je trouve des façons pour qu'on puisse les voir. Mais c'est certain que moi, je vois juste une minorité des gens à qui ça arrive d'une façon quotidienne, probablement à l'hôpital. Donc, il y a certains médecins qui vont trouver des moyens d'assurer que les gens soient vus. Mais il va aussi avoir des gens qui travaillent comme médecins, mais aussi dans l'administration, etc., qui vont potentiellement rendre la vie un peu plus difficile pour les enfants qui veulent accéder aux soins médicaux. Et même des fois, les cartes des enfants qui sont pas nécessairement couverts par l'assurance, leur carte d'hôpital va avoir un trou, ils vont mettre un trou là-dedans pour leur identifier comme d'une façon interne à l'hôpital. Donc la famille va pas nécessairement savoir pourquoi il y a un trou, mais pour les gens qui travaillent là-bas, ils vont savoir que c'est lié au fait que la famille a pas d'assurance. Et puis donc on peut deviner si ça a un effet ou non avec les soins qu'ils vont recevoir. ou s'ils vont être vus de tout court. Mais je pense que la question que tu demandes, la réponse, c'est que oui, certainement, ça va arriver à des gens qui vont avoir des expériences adverses quand ils viennent à l'hôpital. Mm-hmm. Et je pense que ça, c'est une des raisons, un point peut-être qu'on pourra parler après, mais d'où c'est important de parler d'avoir une campagne où les gens puissent accéder aux soins de santé sans avoir besoin de montrer leur carte, par exemple, de carte soleil, là, de carte de...
Excuse-moi, non, il n'y a pas de carte soleil, c'est le papier, le grand papier, là.
C'est ça. Mais en général, la question, c'est peut-être que les gens ne doivent pas montrer ça du tout pour que les gens qui sont sans statut ou les gens qui sont en train de revendiquer leur statut de réfugié puissent venir pour accéder aux soins de santé sans avoir les questions demandées.
Oui. Moi, mon expérience, j'étais dans la pharmacie une fois pour demander de médicaments et je lui ai donné cette papier. La dame, elle m'a dit, mais c'est quoi ça? Et je lui ai dit, c'est mon numéro de téléphone pour que tu m'appelles après pour qu'on sorte prendre un café.
Puis,
il m'a dit, oui, il m'a dit, c'est quoi ça? J'ai dit, parce que j'ai mon numéro de téléphone et j'ai ici et j'aimerais bien que tu m'appelles pour sortir prendre un café. Parce que stupid questions, ouais. They need stupid answer.
Ouais.
I think so.
Ouais, non, je suis d'accord.
Yeah. And, on va parler à Maître toujours Cathy, qui les rit, mais elle avait peut-être fait un petit sourire, là. Tu as entendu ça, mais tu sais que dans le Canada, c'est malgré le bébé qu'il est né au Canada, il n'a pas le droit pour... comme les autres enfants qu'il est né de les enfants qu'il est né des parents réfugiés. Ils n'ont pas encore son statut. Il n'a pas le droit, comme les autres enfants qui sont parents, qu'il a de papier. On parle toujours pour le 60e anniversaire de droits humains.
OK, oui. Mais les enfants, ouais. Des personnes qui revendiquent la statut de réfugié n'ont pas les mêmes droits que les autres enfants, c'est
ouais,
ça?
Oui. I don't know if you hear about.
Mais en fait, c'est comme en fait les enfants devraient, s'ils sont nés ici, dans les faits ou dans la loi, avoir les mêmes droits. Mais c'est sûr, si tu as des parents qui sont marginalisés pour une raison ou l'autre, ou qui sont dans une situation précaire, c'est sûr que ça va avoir un effet sur les enfants. C'est sûr. C'était ça?
Mais c'est dans la loi canadienne. Dans la loi canadienne, les parents d'un enfant, mais les parents ils sont réfugiés, ils n'ont pas de papier encore, ok? Le bébé n'a pas le droit comme tous les enfants. Il ne reçoit pas le 260$ comme les autres. Je ne sais pas ce que vous êtes entendu.
Ok, je comprends. Oui. C'est parce que si on parle des allocations familiales qui sont... C'est ça de quoi tu parles? Oui, les allocations familiales qui sont envoyées par le gouvernement fédéral... Mm-hmm. Ou qui sont envoyés par le gouvernement provincial ici à Québec. Non, c'est vrai que ces prestations-là sont basées sur le statut des parents et la longueur de leur résidence au Canada. Donc, il faut qu'ils soient ici pour 18 mois et qu'ils ont une statut pour les recevoir. Mais si les parents sont sur aide sociale, c'est sûr qu'ils vont recevoir un montant extra, qui est comme pas beaucoup de tout, mais pour leurs enfants, parce qu'ils ne reçoivent pas les prestations du gouvernement.
Madame Cathy, moi, je parle plus entre la différence de bébés qu'ils ont nés ici en Canada et les parents, un qui a des papiers et l'autre qui n'a pas.
Mm-hmm.
Mais pourquoi cette différence, vous voyez, vous, comme une avocate, est-ce que vous voyez ça correct?
Évidemment, je ne suis pas correcte avec, parce que je ne suis pas correcte avec la distinction qui est faite, qui est comme une des plus grandes et plus importantes distinctions qu'on fait ici au Canada. Si tu es citoyen ou si tu n'es pas citoyen. Si tu es citoyen, tu peux être le plus... tu peux commettre des crimes, pas de problème, et on va te traiter en vertu de la système criminel. Seulement, si tu es un résident permanent et tu commets un crime, tu peux perdre ton statut de résident permanent en plus de purger ta peine en prison. Et en plus de ça, alors on va enlever votre statut et on va essayer de vous renvoyer du pays.
Ouais.
Même si vous êtes un réfugié reconnu, puis on sait qu'il y a un danger pour vous dans votre pays. Donc, c'est sûr qu'on fait une grande distinction. Et pour une raison que moi, je ne comprends pas, on accorde tellement d'importance sur la notion de citoyenneté. Et si tu n'es pas un citoyen, c'est sûr que tu as moins de droits que les autres personnes.
OK. Je veux... Yeah, Madame Isabelle, can you talk to me again about the parents, the baby parents, like, doesn't have, like, the people? What's the help you give to them? I don't know if my question's clear for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think one of the first things that we can help with is by offering them or explaining to them some of their opportunities, some of the options that they have. For an example, I guess it depends a lot on why they don't have status, what's their situation. You know, a lot of the people that we see are people who have come on as visitors and have just stayed, and for various reasons have been able to stay here for many, many years, and everything's been okay, and then things fall apart once their baby has been born. For example, having lost their job, having, you know, found themselves without income, therefore found themselves with a newborn baby, without a job, without access to welfare, without access to, you know, a number of the services that people with status or even people with refugee claimants have. So one of the things that we are able to offer is, first of all, access to basic health care. In terms of the nursing and nutrition and the access to doctors. Now I'm talking about from where we are on our, I'm not talking about the services pre-baby, I'm talking about services post-baby.
Yeah.
What we can also do is we can also explore with them what their options are legally. So for an example, are they, you know, we can introduce them to lawyers such as Maître Catherine Ramsey beside us here, who can maybe explore with them whether they're eligible to do a humanitarian application, or perhaps they are eligible to have made a refugee claim and weren't aware of such, which we see which we see sometimes. Sometimes, I mean, so I guess that is sort of our what we can offer. We can sometimes help them find daycares, for an example. We can sometimes hook them up with, link them with family resources for the support system, introduce them to other families in their situation, so perhaps they can share some of the daycare so they can go back to work.
Yeah.
So I guess it's really sort of, you know, targeting a lot of the social issues that are associated with having a baby, the problems that are associated with having such if you don't have status. That's what we try to do, but a lot of it is out of our hands, which is the big struggle. You know, I think it's what a lot of the people like myself, working in government institutions, working with these families, I think that's what we're up against on a regular basis. On one hand, you know, we want to help them. We want to do as much as we possibly can to alleviate some of the social issues, the barriers that are getting in the way of them having a healthy life and family and so on. But a lot of the problems are beyond our control, such as not having access to obstetricians and welfare and so on. I don't know if I've answered your question.
That's very good. That's very good. Thank you, Isabel. Samir, it's... I heard what one story. I'm always talking about the stories where I heard. I heard one baby came from Pakistan, and he born here in Canada. He has a cancer, and he's Canadian, but his parents was like deported, and he had cancer when he was in Pakistan. He's Canadian. He have a right to be here in the hospital, and the Canadian embassy doesn't give his parents the visa. And the kid, 3 years old, he died here without seeing his father. I know this story. It's very shocked many people.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you a bit of what happened. Basically, this is a child that was, like you said, born here. As far as I understood, the family was actually here as refugee claimants several years ago. The mother was accepted, the father wasn't. So the father was basically going to be issued with a deportation order. My understanding was he was issued with a deportation order. My understanding is that they willingly left to go back to Pakistan, the whole family. And then after a couple of years, this child, who was probably around 2 when he was diagnosed, was diagnosed with a cancer that's called a neuroblastoma. And they tried to treat him over there, but they weren't able to cure him. So the mother and the child came back here. Here he received excellent health care, actually, I would say. And the hospital actually went out of their way to, anyway, compared to what I've seen before, they really tried to get the father to come here. The social worker at the hospital was involved, etc. But ultimately, perhaps not surprisingly, the Citizenship and Immigration Canada didn't grant the father a visa. The child continued to get worse, and in November, mid-November, he ended up dying, with the father not having been able to, you know, to come. And basically the mom brought his body back to be buried in Pakistan. So I think this clearly speaks to the reality of, you know, migration and how it has huge, huge, huge effects on people, even years after, you know, a quote unquote failed refugee claimant. It also shows, I think, the arbitrariness of how this child's mother could be accepted and the father is rejected, which we see all the time, these kinds of ridiculous stories. Or these ridiculous judgments, I should say, by the IRB. It's tragic on the one hand, and it's incredibly frustrating and angering, obviously, on the other, because of the fact that, you know, one question I had is, if this kid would have been here, and the family would have been allowed to stay 3 years ago, would he have been picked up earlier, and would he have been able to receive treatment earlier to have prevented his ultimate death? And that's a question I don't think anyone can really answer. But that's, to me, CIC is responsible for that kid's death. You know, and I think that's the for me anyway, one of the take-home points.
Yeah, just the same question. It's for Katya Ramsey. Did you hear Samir what he said when he talking about the mother? She was accepted, the father he was not, and after many years, the kid was the kid is Canadian. He born here. After he died here.
Mm-hmm.
Just I want to see your opinion and this story.
Well, I think, like, sadly enough, it's an all too common story. I think there's just so many Canadians, people in Canada, who don't have a clue, actually, the reality of what's going on in this country in terms of some of the horror stories that we see on a daily basis, where you just have a complete disconnect with reality. You have, you know, refugee decision where one brother's accepted with a story and the other brother with the exact same story is refused, and it's because it's based on the judge that they got that day at the immigration and refugee boards. Some judges accept a lot of people, some judges have a practically 100% refusal rate, and like I said, there's no appeal. So you do find situations that are just really tragic and just illogical, like that, where there just doesn't seem to be any reason why one person was accepted and another person wasn't. Or you have a case where Citizenship and Immigration Canada will say, well, the kids are Canadian. I have 6 kids here who are Canadian and the parents have no status. Well, the parents, we're going to deport the parents. So it's their choice whether they want to take their kids with them or leave their kids here, because their kids have a right to stay. But we don't feel that there's any reason why we should let the parents stay. That's not enough reason. You know, there's just like, there's no humanity with Citizenship and Immigration Canada at all. So we see tragic stories all the time where parents are forced to make a decision whether they are deported with or without their child, you know. And I just want to go back to something that Elizabeth said actually at the beginning of this show, when she was sort of talking about how she felt they're failed, that where she works, they're sort of maybe failing in terms of people without status in the preventative area. And obviously, as a lawyer, we're not there to be preventative. That's not our role. And no one ever comes to see a lawyer because they want to. They normally come and see a lawyer because they have no choice and things have just gone very, very bad. But I would say that 40% of the time when I see people, it's absolutely too late for me to do anything. It's been years and years without status and the recourses are so limited. And I've basically been only doing just immigration law for 3 months and already there's been 3 or 4 or 5 people deported. And it's just because by the time we see them and there's just nothing to do and there's no recourses that are properly available here to really stop it. So we see all the time people who've been here for 20 years lost their status for sometimes minor criminal issues and they're being separated from their entire family and just deposited in their country where they haven't been in 20 years, and that's sort of the end of the story. So you see stories like that all the time.
Isabel, did you hear about something like this? The story like this?
In terms of the children?
Yeah, did you hear something like this? With the work, yeah. I don't know if you had experience with the kids.
Well, I've worked with several families, yeah. And some who Kathy has seen as well, where there's, you know, one member of the family has been able to attain their status and others haven't, if that's what you're... I used to work in the schools, and oftentimes I would meet families through, you know, something happening with the child at school, for an example. And upon further evaluation, I would realize that, you know, the child's been here, you know, the child was born here. The child's 9, 10 years old, and the family doesn't have status. So, for an example, upon meeting mother, you know, she's, you know, hasn't seen a doctor in 10 years. She hasn't been able to, get a movie store card or the library card or take the kid to the YMCA or is afraid to come to the CLSC or, you know, so many things affect her, you know, Canadian born and raised child because she doesn't have her status. I don't know if that's the kind of stories you're looking at or if, you know, for an example, or another family where the parents have their status, but the kids don't have it yet. So the kids haven't been going to school, and so on.
Yeah, we heard about the same. Yeah, the kids doesn't have people. They want school, and the immigration came and took them and deported them again. I don't know if you heard about the story the same year. In Toronto, the kids, he was like arrested by immigration, deported.
I can't remember the name of the family that was, I think, in 2007. But I can't remember the name of that family, but it definitely happened. And I think because of that, there was a campaign that started actually as part of this Don't Ask, Don't Tell campaign in Toronto to make sure that CBSA, the Canadian Border Service Agencies, aren't able to go into the schools anymore. And for basically the school boards to sign on to a don't ask, don't tell policy to ensure that that doesn't happen so that kids who are there without papers or whatnot can actually at least have access to a free education while they're in Canada.
Okay, thank you. The musician, are you ready for the third song?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, go for it, guys, because because we still only 7 minutes. After we go to with Metro Kati for question how we get studs.
This is La Porte d'en Arrière by Léa Minard.
Okay.
You can sing along.
Je m'en sais, je m'en porte la main. La petite, je t'aime.
C'est bon. Merci beaucoup, guys. So sweet voice, guys. Ah, it's good, good, good. The last question for Cathy. Cathy, s'il vous plaît, j'aimerais savoir, le monde qui n'a pas de papier ou qui veut faire application, c'est quoi les étapes, les gens qui n'ont pas de papier, c'est quoi les étapes qu'ils peuvent faire pour obtenir son statut?
Well, the first thing somebody can do is make a refugee claim, which a lot of people do when they first arrive, but a lot of people don't right away, especially in cases of domestic violence, because a lot of women don't know that they can actually make a refugee claim in those circumstances, so they'll do it after they've been here for a year and a half and met someone who's told them, no, that's a valid reason for making a refugee claim. But if you lose your refugee claim, your recourses are really limited. Or if you come on a visitor's visa and you overstay and you find yourself in a situation without status, there is really, from inside Canada, only two things you can do. The first is a humanitarian application, which is based on your establishment in Canada, how many ties you have here, if you've been contributing to Canadian society, which is sometimes very difficult for people who are in very marginalized positions to do, by their definition, if you have children here. And the second thing is just if there be hardship for you to apply for status if you were in your own country. But those humanitarian applications take now about 3 or 4 years to be processed, and they don't stop your deportation. So most people don't really have the time for that to be processed unless there's a problem with removing them from Canada. The other option is really an inland spousal sponsorship. If someone's married to a Canadian citizen or a permanent resident, they can do a spousal sponsorship, and that will, in certain circumstances, stop their deportation until it's processed, and that takes a lot less time. Otherwise, before a person can be deported, there's something that's called the pre-removal risk assessment, which is, to me, a joke. It's accepted in 1 or 2% of cases. It's basically so Canada can say, we respect the Convention Against Torture. We check if there's risks for someone before they're deported, but everyone knows it's a joke. They're very rarely, rarely accepted. And once a person has done that once, even if the conditions in their countries change, they can be deported once they've done that pre-removal risk assessment and failed, which most people do. And for any of those applications, if they're refused, you can go to federal court, not on an appeal, but a super limited judicial review. Again, 10-15% of those are even allowed to proceed on the merits or to be fully debated in court, because you have to get permission from a judge to even go to court and argue in the first place, which is sometimes very hard to do. And those are basically your options in Canada, if you hear about status.
That's the options. Yeah. That's the option.
Pretty limited.
Very limited. Isabel, last, I want you to say 3 or 4 words. What you wish, what you hope.
What I wish and what I hope for is that... Is that frontline health and social services are able to separate people's immigration situation from the fact that healthcare, is a universal human right.
Samir, what do you hope and what do you wish?
I think for me the question is that so long as Citizenship Immigration Canada decides who can come and can't come to this land, which is not Citizenship and Immigration Canada's to decide, because it's all native land that people have been settling on over the last few centuries. The only true justice would be first to recognize that, and secondly to basically open borders so people can come as they wish, and CIC become eliminated, because CIC, I think, in and of itself causes people illness, whether it be physical, emotional, mental. And only once that's gone and rid of can we start talking about, being able to provide good healthcare and things like that. So that's my wish. That's not going to happen in the next few years. So in the meanwhile, I think that at the very least, there should be some kind of a don't ask, don't tell type of, campaign, healthcare for all here that we start working on.
Thank you, Samir, so much. And we say goodbye, and we talk next month.
A
quick extra here from the Radio Sanctuary. That's just concluding. That does do it for this edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective, with assistance tonight from Abdelkader Balouni, who today participated in Radio 1812, marking the International Migrants Day. Radio Sanctuary was picked up by hundreds of more radio stations participating in Radio 1812. So Google that if you want more information about that. Thank yous due to all of those who support community-created radio. If you want more information about CKUT's Community News Department, you can always give us a call at 514-448-4041, extension 6788. And if this was your first time listening to Radio Sanctuary, this was indeed the 27th installment. So do stay tuned next month for another edition of Radio Sanctuary.
Oh, guys.